the guy reaching into his jacket, and he has like a mouse trap in there. And
yeah. Just in case.
Welcome to Gold, Diamonds, and Death, a James Bond podcast. I am your 00 host, Jonathan Watkins. I am a writer for all things under the CinemaSins brand name and a co-host of the Behind the Sins podcast. Joining me in each and every week for this endeavor, he is the co-founder of CinemaSins, co-host of the weekly podcast, Recotopia, huge, huge fan of Las Vegas. I don't know how many elephants you've done slot machines with, but...
I'm gonna have to get back to you on that one. That's a tough question.
But he's also one of my good friends, Mr. Chris Atkinson. How are you doing, my
Hello,
friend?
Hello, doing all right. Absolutely.
Awesome. We are going to talk about today. We are talking about, as I mentioned, Vegas. That can only mean one thing. I think this is the only one in Vegas, right? That can only mean one thing. We are talking about Diamonds Are Forever, the final Sean Connery film, at least in the Eon Productions portion of this franchise, and the first James Bond film of the 1970s, which I think is kind of a big deal, because it was, you know, a lot of people were curious what James Bond was going to look like in the 70s, and well, here you go. We'll talk about it. So let's go ahead and get into this. We are going to go into our first segment where we discuss the behind the scenes stuff. We like to call this Eon Flux.
This is a journey.
I'm gonna make a movie!
We have to go back, Kate.
Wow, how did you know all that stuff?
I did my research.
I don't understand any of this.
What the fuck is going on?
We are gonna scour through the history of Eon Productions, give you all the highs and lows that went into the making of these films. So, Diamonds Are Forever. So, we talked about Honor Majesty's Secret Service last week. In 2022, we all know how legendary of an actor George Lazenby is. I mean, all the awards... Mm-hmm.
Right.
All the just the feats, like, you know, he climbed mountains and I think he repaired the Statue of Liberty by himself. Like, you know, it's crazy.
First time, three time EGOT winner,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly.
Too.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So George Lazenby, we talked about this last week. He was offered a 6 or 7 film contract. It was something crazy. It makes no sense after you watch Honor Majesty. Even though Honor Majesty's Secret Service is a really good movie, his performance, it's kind of odd that they offered this to him. But he turned it down because he was kind of like, I don't think I like acting very much.
Mm-hmm.
So Sean Connery gets to return. There's a little bit behind the scenes of that, but this is Sean Connery's return. This is his sixth Bond film. It's the seventh film in the franchise, so it's kind of this weird, like, I don't know, it's weird how, like, I don't know in my entire life if I've watched Diamonds Are Forever after I watched Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Like, I don't know that I've ever watched those in order,
right?
And it's weird watching like going from You Only Live Twice to Honor Majesty's Secret Service and then to Diamonds Are Forever. It's almost like we kind of go back 2 steps, maybe forward 1.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But but this is what we're having to deal with today. So Connery also, I should say, got a record at that time salary of $1.25 million. So they really wanted him. I don't even know what that would be today, but at that time, it was a lot of money. I still remember thinking, like, when in my time that I can remember that being a big deal, when Bruce Willis got paid $5 million to do Die Hard. Which, to be fair, he had done, like, nothing other than television. He was a huge television star. But still, it's just crazy to think what people get paid now. Like,
well, it wasn't long after that.
No, that people started getting, like, $20 million, right?
$20 million, yeah. That, I mean, it was, like, 5 years. But that was a lot of to do with the Sony, the weird Sony stuff going
on. Yeah, because I think, because you get into, what, Jim Carrey and Schwarzenegger and people like that, Tom Cruise, people
Adam
like that.
Sandler.
Yeah, Mel Gibson, I think Lethal Weapon 4, I think he got like $40 million or something. I mean,
that's
something crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But people were like, you know, freaking out over Sean Connery getting $1.25 million, which in 1970 or whatever this was when they started
and
filming.
To be fair, too, he didn't take this money either. He donated it to a Scottish trust of some sort.
Which I thought was really
for
cool.
For artists. Yeah. So.
Yeah, because on top of the $1.25 million, he also got guaranteed back-to-back films that he could choose after this was made. I didn't see what the second one was, but the first
The
one,
Offense.
The Offense was the
called.
First one, but that was
the only one.
Oh, that was the only. They didn't do the second one. Okay, I guess I missed that somehow.
Yeah, there was a discussion in the behind the scenes about it, and they got The Offense done, and the guy from United Artists comes on there and he says, you know, it doesn't matter. We got him back for one more bond. That was the main point. So yeah, I don't think he ever did that second one was Bond. And I mean, the second one was The Offense. I don't know.
Oh, I got you. I see what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, I guess you could read that a few different ways, but yeah, The Offense is actually a pretty good movie. It's Sidney Lumet directed it. It's pretty dark. Like it's been a while since I've seen it. He's a cop, and he is like obsessed with taking down this pedophile. He knows this guy is a pedophile, and like it's just about him. And so it's kind of that around that time we had like Dirty Harry, which actually Dirty Harry came out the same year as Diamonds Are Forever, and actually finished right below it at the box office. And so you kind of had in the '70s, you had these like kind of, the darker cop movies, I guess, started, which have now sadly become kind of a scary reality, but,
Yep.
So anyways, get back to Bond. So Sean Connery is not only returning, Guy Hamilton, is back. Peter Hunt directed, Honor Majesty's Secret Service. He was offered, the job to come back. He was working on another movie, so he said he would come back if they could delay the production. They said they didn't want to do that, so they were on this kind of 2 year a new Bond film comes out, which they do for quite a while. I think through License to Kill, I think they do every 2 years, and then we get like that 6 year gap or whatever between that and Brosnan, and then of course with Craig it's been all kinds of gaps, but so they wanted to stick to that. So they got Guy Hamilton back, which was kind of makes sense because not only do they bring Guy Hamilton back, they also bring Shirley Bassey back to do the theme song. And the original idea was that they were really wanting to kind of go back and capture, I guess, that magic that they considered to be Goldfinger. Richard Maybaum originally, before they realized Lazenby wasn't going to do it, they were working on like more of a revenge film where Bond is going after Blofeld because he's out for revenge for him killing his wife. Whereas in the final film, that's handled in the first like 2 minutes and it's ridiculous. So that was the original. Then when Lazenby wasn't coming back, they decided to go a different direction. So Maybaum is still writing it. He writes an original script that actually had Auric Goldfinger's twin brother seeking revenge for the death of Auric Goldfinger. They were going to bring, all of a sudden I forgot his name, Frober.
It's Gert Frobe.
Thank you. Gert Frobe, they were going to bring him back. And this even got to the point where they kept going through drafts of this, and eventually it became, at one point, Blofeld was going to be Goldfinger's twin brother somehow. I don't really, consider we had already had like two versions that looked nothing like him. They were going to bring Gert Frobe back for that as well. So they were doing that, and supposedly what I read and what I read in interviews and stuff like that was that the plot was later changed based on a dream that Broccoli had where Howard Hughes, who's a friend of his, replaced an imposter.
Yeah.
Or was replaced by an imposter.
Yeah. And this is a really interesting dynamic too. Did you read the stuff about Jimmy Dean in this?
Because Jimmy Dean was nervous because he worked for Howard Hughes. Is that right? Yeah, he was under contract.
He worked at the Desert Inn, I believe. He had a residency there, maybe, or something like that. And apparently Hughes also gets. He gets 16mm versions of Bond films before they're released or something like
that. I didn't see that. No, that's crazy.
Something to that effect. I mean, maybe Jimmy Dean is just saying like maybe in a world, but I don't know, but he was worried, yes, that Howard Hughes was going to see this and say that, "Oh, that's I don't like this portrayal of me," and he fires him.
Yeah, but it's interesting because and Howard Hughes was all for this, by the way. They filmed at some of Howard Hughes' casinos. Yep. I mean, there's a lot of filming in Vegas, and
Yeah, he was very cool with it.
Yeah, he's very cool with it. And on, I got to say, I mean, Jimmy Dean really isn't playing Howard Hughes, though. Like, he's not playing, like, he's not.
No.
He was just replaced by an imposter, but there's nothing about the Jimmy Dean character. Now, the Willard White is the character's name that's supposed to be the Howard Hughes. Now, the Willard White that gets created by Blofeld, like what Blofeld creates Willard White, he's more of a Howard Hughes. Like, they haven't seen him in 3 years.
For sure.
But you would assume if Jimmy Dean was Willard White was actually in that, that wouldn't be the case. I mean, you don't get that impression from what we see of him. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, in this, he's not a recluse by choice, really.
That's what I'm trying to say.
You know, that's the other part of it. So
yeah, they have to, for Blofeld to pull this off, they have to do this thing where he's a recluse and no one has seen him for like 3 years or whatever. And which also makes you wonder why Willard White's still alive, but that's a whole other thing. I guess we'll get into that more when we get into the review. But anyway, so that ended up being where they took off from that. And then actually, Broccoli then goes on to hire Tom Mankiewicz of the Mankiewicz clans. I mean, even today, we've got like Ben Mankiewicz over at Turner Classic and Josh Mankiewicz of Dateline fame.
These are all related? All people related?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're all related. Joseph Mankiewicz, of course, is the famous director, right? Is that right?
Well, he was, I think, mostly a writer. Citizen Kane was his big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, they're all related. I can't remember if that's like Ben and Josh, which Josh Mankiewicz is on Dateline, maybe most famous now for Bill Hader impressions of him, where but you didn't do that, did you? I think Joseph's their grandfather, but he could be their uncle. I can't remember, but they're all related. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Mankiewicz gets brought in to rework the script. He was partly hired because Broccoli wanted an American writer, because he thought British writers wrote terrible American gangsters, which based on Goldfinger, he might be right. I honestly don't have a problem with him doing that. And Mankiewicz is a good writer. So John Gavin, who I know mostly as the original Sam Loomis from Psycho, my Twitter handle namesake. He was originally considered to play Lazenby. So it wasn't Connery at first. In fact, they ended up having to pay Gavin because I guess they had him contracted long enough.
He was ready to go.
Other names that supposedly were mentioned, although I don't know how serious this was, Clint Eastwood, Adam West, Burt Reynolds, all three of which, according to what I read, said they didn't think Bond should be an American actor, so they never really took it that seriously. Robert Wagner, which is really interesting. We'll get into that later.
Sure.
It has nothing to do with the fact that he would have played Bond, but there's just other relations to him that come up later. Yeah. Michael Gambon supposedly rejected an offer because he didn't feel like he didn't want to get in shape for the role, is what I read. Okay. I don't know if that's true, but
sounds.
Yeah, I mean, okay. I'm not sure. I wouldn't turn down roles because of that. Like some of these Marvel movies and stuff. I'd be
You have to spend a whole much time of your life just getting in shape
and
for the movie.
You can't eat. Like I don't know. Amy Schumer. I don't remember if it's stand up or what it was, but she does this great bit about when she went to meet with a trainer for some movie role she got, and just the way he was like, okay, so what I want you to do in the morning is have a smoothie, and then for lunch I want you to do a diary entry about drinking that smoothie.
Oh god.
I don't know, it's just really funny. Roger Moore also was approached. They've really, really wanted Roger Moore, obviously. Mm-hmm. He was filming a new TV series, though, which I guess didn't last that long. It's called The Persuaders. What little I read of it, it was kind of what they considered to be the last of like the action, like The Saint and Danger Man and those types of TV shows that were coming out around that time. Mm-hmm. It was him, and I think Oliver Reed was in it, too. But I didn't write that down, but I'm pretty sure that's what I read. But anyways, regardless, they ended up finally deciding to go with Connery. He agreed to do it for the $1.25 million. He was also guaranteed two back-to-back films. We at least know he made The Offense. The other one obviously never got made. But other actors in the movie, Charles Gray is the, I guess, third person we see play Blofeld. He's also in You Only Live Twice as a different character, which is something we do see in a lot of these films moving forward. They do stuff like
this. That's a really interesting one though, because I had forgotten that Charles Gray played Blofeld later on when I saw him in You Only Live Twice. And he's that guy that Bond connects with when he's is it in Japan at the time? Yeah, it's in Japan at the time. And he's in that whatever that house, and somebody comes in and like stabs him through the house or whatever. And Bond has to chase after. Yeah.
And I don't even know how much we talked about him. I know him though as the criminologist in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. He's the
yes.
That's who I've always known him as. So anytime I see him in anything else, that's all I can think of is like him in Rocky Horror Picture Show. Putter Smith, who was a jazz musician, he came on to play Mr. Kidd. I will say up front, I kind of love these characters.
I love them to death. I think they're great.
Oh, they're so good.
Yeah.
To the point where I'm kind of sad they never came back. Like, they killed them and didn't let them come back. Like, we had to have, like, which we'll talk about this when we get into the movies, but, like, Jaws, for instance, is a character that, like, I'm not as big on. He became like a fan favorite, and I don't have anything against the actor, but like these are actually two characters. It would have been awesome to see them come back. But he played Mr. Kidd, and then we just said two characters. The other character is Mr. Wendt. Paul Williams was cast originally, but then he couldn't agree on compensation. So Bruce Glover. It's interesting the Hollywood, and I think we send this in the Sins video, we made a joke about this because you have Natalie Wood's sister and Crispin Glover's dad are in this movie. And I think we kind of made jokes referencing like discount Crispin Glover's or it could be his dad or whatever. So he ended up coming on, which I think I love Paul Williams. I am a huge fan of the Paradise fan. I'm so glad Bruce Glover. I think Bruce Glover is perfect for this role. I think him and Putter Smith play really well off each other. It's definitely implied that they are a couple, which is interesting.
I think more than implied.
I think it's definitely shown that they are a couple. I mean, they at the first scene where we see them kill the doctor and the blow up the helicopter, when they walk off, they're holding hands and for some reason in my mind, I remembered them skipping. I don't know why I remember, but that's not what happens. But I don't know why I had that in my mind. But I love the puns like back and forth and
In the behind the scenes, one of the interesting things, and I don't know how gay relationships have been shown at this point in the early 70s, but it feels way more progressive than anything that has come out around this time,
especially in a Bond film,
and they don't even make a real comment on it at all. There's not a lot of innuendo, even though there's maybe a couple.
Yeah,
but like Putter Smith in the behind the scenes said something like, it was pretty obvious that these guys were gay. From reading it, and it's like, you don't have to act gay. You just have to tell the audience that they're gay, and then you everybody knows that you're gay. And that's what, so there's none of this flamboyant, like over the top type of thing that we would see later on, it's really interesting for a 1971 movie.
And then Bruce Cabot, he plays Bert Saxby. I love these character names, by the way. This is maybe my favorite, other than Plenty O'Toole, which is stupid. But I love these character names. I mean, Tiffany Case, White, Willard White, Mr. Kent, and Mr. Wendt and Mr. Kidd. But Bruce Cabot, this was his final film role. He died, I think, I don't know if it was before the movie came out, but he died shortly after this all happened. He didn't appear to be that old. I don't think he was, maybe in his 50s. And then Jimmy Dean, we already talked about. He plays Willard White. We already mentioned at the time he was an employee of Hughes at the Desert End. So he was a little nervous playing this role because it was directly, related to Howard Hughes, even though Howard Hughes, obviously behind the scenes, was helping out a lot. So
Bruce Cabot died at 68. It was lung cancer, lung and throat cancer.
He looked good for being in his 60s.
May have been a smoker. I don't know, but that's what it said.
But man, he did not look like he was in his 60s. I would have never guessed that. I would have thought he was like 52 or something. He kind of reminds me of Mr. Walton from the
Yeah.
He kind of looks like him. Jill St. John ends up playing Tiffany Case. Originally, I believe, I don't know if she actually got cast, but originally she was going to get the role of Plenty O'Toole. And then just through, I didn't really see what exactly happened, but she, for whatever reason, they decided to make her Tiffany Case. She became the first American Bond girl.
Mm-hmm.
And partly why she was cast, I read, was because she didn't have long hair. That was...
Okay.
It's the stupidest shit about why they cast some of these people.
Really dumb stuff.
And Jill St. John is perfectly fine in this movie. There's absolutely, I mean, she does a good job with the role. She's has good chemistry with Connery for the most part, which makes sense because they were hooking up behind the scenes. But yeah, I don't know. Some of this stuff is just, I don't know. And maybe people do get cast like that still. I don't know, but it's bizarre to like read this stuff and have people like say it like it makes perfect sense that that's why they cast her.
Yeah.
Lana Wood, Natalie Wood's sister, she was cast as Plenty O'Toole eventually. She claims she modeled her role partially after Minnie Mouse. I don't know that I see that.
Okay. Yeah.
But what's interesting, I will bring this up. I know I talked about this way back when we send these. I talked about this on Behind the Scenes because I found it so fascinating. So... First off, Jill St. John and Lana Wood on set reportedly both hook up with Connery. So they're already kind of having issues with each other because, you know, they're, you know, Connery's with both of them. And that could be more of a Connery thing than anything to do with either one of them. But they're having some issues. But then what's interesting about this is Robert Wagner, of course, married to Natalie Wood. This is very famous. You can Google this, and I'm not going to get into all the theories and possibilities, but... Natalie Wood dies mysteriously while on a cruise ship, or not a cruise ship, but on a boat. I know Christopher Walken and Robert Wagner are definitely on that boat. I don't know if anybody else is. I don't even remember the whole story myself. So there's been, up to this day, they're still making documentaries. There's a lot of speculation that Robert Wagner had something to do with it. He's never been charged as far, I don't think he's been charged. I don't think even
and
at the time.
And the more and more I hear about it, the more I don't think there was any chance in hell he had anything to do with it. But
I haven't paid a ton of attention to it, but my wife watches a lot of true crime stuff. So I see, she's watched, like there was a pretty recent documentary like on Showtime or HBO in the last year or two that was called Natalie, I think, and it was just kind of talking about everything. So I know that happened, but Robert Wagner, which it's, I mean, I think Natalie Wood dies like around like 1981 or something, 80. Robert Wagner ends up marrying Jill St. John in 1990. They're still married. They're still married to this day. So, and Lana Wood is very much an advocate that Robert Wagner had something to do with her sister's death. So it's just interesting that they were in this movie together. They had this on-set bullshit with Connery. And then this continues because Jill St. John, of course, ends up marrying her former brother-in-law. And I don't know. Just thought that was just one of those things that like you can't like, I don't even know how you write that. It's just
just imagine all the weird connections if Wagner plays Bond in this. But Wagner apparently knew Jill St. John back when she was like 18 years old or something like that. It's like that's how long that they've known each other.
I can't remember if they had actually I don't think they had dated or anything, but I knew they had known each other forever when they got married.
I believe the documentary says that I think Natalie Wood went out alone on a boat or something like that. I think that's how that happened. She went out alone, and I can't remember exactly what it was after that. But
I shouldn't have said anything. Because I just don't know enough. That's what I'm saying. You can Google it, or
the problem is also you'll never know if you think that there's going to be some sort of like weird evidence that pops up out of nowhere. Yeah. If you're like really think Robert Wagner's behind this, and also if you wanted to extend this further to the weirdness, Robert Wagner eventually plays number two in the Austin Powers movie.
That's true. So he ends up being a Bond parodies. And he's also interesting, like Heart to Heart is definitely not based on James Bond, but there is kind of a, he's like a rich, debonair You know, and he gets involved in all these, like, he has to solve all these cases and stuff.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, so that's interesting. There was a cameo that was filmed with Sammy Davis Jr., which is now a deleted scene on a lot of the physical media out there. It was definitely on the Blu-ray I had, but it's...
Yeah, and I don't typically watch the deleted scenes.
I don't know why I did on this one. I was just like, I'm going to watch a deleted scene.
I'm almost certain that it's probably on this disc that I watched. Yeah, it probably is. So.
Because it was filmed. It's a scene with him, and I think he's playing himself, but he's playing, like, craps or something, or, like, roulette or something, mm-hmm. and... Bert Saxby comes up to him and is like, hey man, he might even call him Sammy, so he might be himself, but he's like, hey man, just letting you know, I talked to Willard and on the phone, and he said you hadn't signed your contract yet, which I can't figure out why, like, Blofeld is still, like, running things that way, like, he's still making mm-hmm. sure, like, the talent is signing their contract.
I don't know,
but there was a whole scene there, and then James Bond walks in and they, like, Sammy Davis Jr. says something, like, some joke about how James Bond looks coming into, like, an American. I think it was supposed to be kind of making fun of, like, and I do like this aspect of the movie, although they don't really mess around with it too much. But we've seen Bond in, like, all these other casino scenes, right? Like in Monte mm-hmm. Carlo and stuff like that. So it's just interesting to see him, like, in Vegas, which is a very different, especially in the 70s, very different mm-hmm. casino scene than, like, something like Monte Carlo. And so Bond kind of sticks out because he's, like, all decked out and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It was all right. But, I mean, I just thought it was interesting that it would happen. I'm not upset it wasn't in the movie.
Yeah.
Lois Maxwell almost wasn't in the movie. She demanded a pay increase. So Moneypenny was not in the film. But then there is this scene where she shows up. So I didn't see if they actually agreed to pay her what she wanted. But she does get a scene where she actually gets to be undercover. Which is not a usual thing.
It is an absolutely bizarre scene, by the
everything
way.
About
if it's coming, if it's coming after Honor Majesty's Secret Service, everything about it is weird. Like, here's a guy who supposedly lost the love of his life in the last movie, and then she's like, you know, like intimating to him that she wants him to bring back, I don't know, no, the kind of diamond that comes on a ring.
Oh, it's crazy.
Blah blah blah, and all this other stuff. It's like, dude, that's too soon. And then they even reference that this is the first time I've seen this since 2006 when I was watching them all in a row, and I didn't really even pay much attention to the continuity. But he says something like, how about a tulip? And she's like, oh, I'll totally take that, which is a reference to the last movie as well.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's such a weird scene.
Do you remember, I don't want to use a tangent, but what I thought about when I was watching this movie, especially early on, do you remember that season of 24 where at the end of the season, for some reason, they make some deal, like the Chinese, I don't know if it's the Chinese government or if they, like, make up who it is, like, but it's an Asian government wants mm-hmm. Jack Bauer for something. Like, he committed, he was like, he like barged into their embassy. I can't remember what it was. And, like, mm-hmm. they end up agreeing to send him to, like, Asian prison. And then the next season starts, and, like, he comes back. They get him back for some reason. He's been, like, tortured or whatever for the past, like, year and a half, and he, like, cuts his hair, and then he's fine. Like, mm-hmm. that's what I kept thinking about when I was watching this movie. It's like, just
man,
going
I don't
through,
even
like,
know if I
horrible...
saw that season of 24, huh? But that sounds... I don't think I even saw that season of 24.
That was towards
but,
the end. It was when 24 wasn't as good, from what I remember.
Yeah, I think there was a season that I missed at some point, and I saw most of them.
It was post season 5, because I remember after season 5, it starts getting less good. That's a show, if I ever have the time, which I don't know when this will be, maybe we'll do a 24 podcast, but I've always been curious how that show plays now. I've always been, because I mean, I loved that show. I know you did too. Mm-hmm. I think Jeremy did too for at least the first few seasons.
I watched it every episode. Yeah, every week I was glued to watching that.
But yeah, that was when it started getting a little insane. Was when he was just all of a sudden he was recovered from like a year and a half of being tortured by the the Chinese government or whatever. Very different than losing a wife. But I don't know. It was just the idea of just coming back so quickly. I don't know. But so that's kind of it for the cast. All this was pretty much shot in the U.S. There was actually a reason for that. Hamilton had like pissed off some union people or something when he was shooting this movie called The Battle of Britain. So they they let him shoot in the United States, so he didn't have to deal with that. There was some stuff done at Pinewood, but it was very little. Most of it was done in Vegas, including the South African stuff was in the desert outside of Vegas, as was, I think, the moon stuff. The moon stuff. We already mentioned Howard Hughes was a friend of Brock Lee, so most of the hotel scenes are ones he owns.
So maybe that's true about the and maybe I didn't miss here. He was probably getting Bond 16mm Bond films to watch before the movie even came out then, so that really actually happened.
Yeah, probably did. He was a lot of the hotel scenes are ones that he owns, but they also the Las Vegas Hilton, that doubled for the White House and which there's like a 10-minute segment of this movie that feels like a commercial for Circus. And apparently that guy was a huge Bond fan, the guy who owns Circus. So that he let them just come film the circus stuff. I don't think he charged them. Like he was just like, yeah, come on.
Yeah.
So they were able to that's why you get all this stuff in the Circus, including, as we've already mentioned, the elephant pulling the slot machine.
That scene, by the way, is just, I know, like when you're making these, you don't want to, you're trying to make something that's fun and you put in some jokes and all that. That's full blown Naked Gun type stuff.
Oh, that's parody.
Like, that makes no sense that it's in there.
That's like 1967 Casino Royale. Like that's a scene that would have been in that movie. Right.
Yeah.
And like you would have had, I thought it was interesting too. The set that was Tiffany's house. It wasn't a set; it was a house, but it was Kirk Douglas's house.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that he owned out there. The movie also had to make a deal with Ford because they needed to film a bunch of car crashes. So Ford apparently was fine with that, but they demanded that Connery be driving the 1971 Mustang Mach 1. The only reason I mentioned that is my first car was a 1971 Mustang, so I thought that was really cool. I did not have the Mach 1, but I did have a 1971 Mustang. That was my first car. It was my dad's first car, and he kept it and had it restored for me, so that was really cool. The NASA Lunar Rover, which was the moon scene we were talking about, that was custom built so they could actually make it drive faster. I guess the actual, and they also had to change the tires because all the heat in Vegas from the sand and stuff was melting, or not melting, but it was causing a lot of issues with the fiberglass. So they had to custom built that. So that's why, if you're thinking that like there's no way that would go that fast, well, it wouldn't. The crazy stunt with the Mustang jumping the ramp, I read, resulted in a few cars getting wrecked by the original stuntman. So they only had one working car left, so they just went ahead and called this other guy in that one of them knew, and he pulled it off with no issue. Also, this is interesting because I didn't know this when we send it, because I don't know why I would have come across this, but we send, of course, because there's a huge continuity error in this movie where the car flips up on its side to go down an alley and then it comes out on the other side. But from what I understand, they filmed it both ways or something, and then instead of using, I don't know if there was just something wrong with part of the shot, so then they kind of put them together.
So they had an American stunt team try to do it, and that American stunt team couldn't do it, so then they got a French stunt team to come out and do it.
Yeah.
And they came out on the wrong side. Yeah. And when they were shooting, they were showing the dailies, Guy Hamilton said, I don't give a shit. It's the car's on two wheels. It doesn't matter if it's on the wrong side or not.
Yeah.
But then they decided to put in that stupid shot that's in the middle of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Where they're making it seem like all in one weird motion that it goes from left to right, which is impossible in itself. And I don't know how we ended up framing that sin, but like that's supposed to explain why that happens, and you can't make your car go from two wheels on one side to another very smoothly like that. But they do that in the movie to explain the continuity error or fix it or whatever. But
whatever. We send it 50 years later. Guy Hamilton can get over it.
That's right. He can eat a dick.
He should have taken more time.
Yeah.
There's also a deleted scene that shows why, because one of the confusing things in the movie is that Plenty O'Toole dies at Tiffany's house. They don't know each other as far as we know, But what you find out is there's a whole sequence where Bond and Plenty O'Toole are going to go upstairs to hook up in his room. Tiffany Case is there and her goons, one of which is played by Sid Haig, which I think is who becomes famous later, the late Sid Haig now, but became famous later for being in a bunch of Rob Zombie films. But they throw her off the roof where she lands in this pool and somehow survives. It's ridiculous. The fact that people think you can land in a pool from that far up and survive is at least she would have like a broken ankle or something. But anyways, she apparently comes back up to get her clothes. And while she's in this scene, doesn't make a lot of sense. While she's in there, she gets irritated because she sees that Tiffany Case and Bond are having sex. So she's kind of peeved. And she goes and looks in Tiffany Case's purse and finds her address and then decides to go to her house to, like, confront her. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So I kind of see why they took it out, but also it's very confusing as to why she's the one dead in the pool.
Yeah, apparently also they shot that with a stunt woman at first and for part of it, and then it was Lana Wood for a lot of that, a lot of that stunt. And
you're talking about when she's dead in the pool or when she gets thrown off?
When she's getting thrown.
Oh, okay.
There's a... apparently, like, you know, she's being thrown off and she's basically naked is what she's saying. Mm-hmm. And like, they were like, oh, it's going to be at night. Nobody's going to be looking at the pool. And it's like, you're talking about Vegas. Yeah. Everybody's watching. Oh. So, like, everybody was watching when they were doing that stunt.
Of course. And then they actually, I actually read too, she was partially, because she dies in Tiffany Case's pool, where they've, like, tied her to the bottom, like, with a, you know, whatever. She was actually tied down there. They just had it, I guess they had the water level to where, in between takes, she could raise up and like get a breath. But I thought that was interesting because, like, that would, I don't even think they do that now because that would be terrifying.
No, they wouldn't do that.
Well, even if somebody asked me, like, can we tie your, no, you can't fucking tie my feet to a goddamn weight. There's no way. So that's pretty much that. Diamonds Are Forever, it came out December of 71. It would grow on to gross 116 million worldwide, 43 of which was in the US. It was a big hit. Finished fifth at the U.S. box office, made a little more than Dirty Harry, made a little less than this movie called Summer of 42, which I've heard of, but I've never seen.
Same.
Yeah. Other three movies that were ahead of it, French Connection, obviously, Billy Jack, which I know that was a really popular movie that I've never, I don't like it, but I mean, I guess at the time it was something that people enjoyed. Fiddler on the Roof, which I've never seen, that was the number one movie that year by a lot.
I've seen it, but I didn't realize it was that huge.
Yeah, it was huge. People really wanted to. The main guy in it is that one of those one name actors. It's like Topol or something. So I guess people were really into him that year. They were like, we love Topol. French Connection, of course, wins the Best Picture Oscar that year, though. Movie got decent reviews when it was released. It was all kind of the level of, this is really silly, but I'm having fun. Roger Ebert was a big proponent of it. He didn't love it, but he just said it was a lot of fun. He said he liked all the silly stuff, like the moon car, and he liked the Las Vegas car chase. Talk about a scene that makes to where there's like, at one point, there's no traffic, which even on Fremont Street, I don't believe that.
Yeah. I know.
I mean, now they have some of that closed off, so I would believe it now, but I don't think they did then, but I could be wrong.
They did have it closed down.
They had it closed down for the shoot, but I'm saying, did they have it closed down?
Oh, I mean, you mean if like this happened in real life or whatever? Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. That was one thing though. I don't think they would, but, they had to shut down Vegas for 5 days basically. It's like Broccoli and, either Broccoli or Saltzman, apparently, you know, cause they knew people were able to get that done.
I'm sure Howard Hughes factored into that.
I'm sure he did.
That's great. I honestly didn't know that. Like, I guess I had known that Willard White was supposed to, the Blofeld version of Willard White, I guess I kind of knew was supposed to be Howard Hughes, but I had no idea that Howard Hughes was like actually a person that they knew. And
I didn't either.
I mean, I don't know a ton about Howard Hughes though, so I guess that's not that crazy. It did get negative reviews as well. Gene Siskel was one of the ones I saw that really hated it. He had nothing good to say about it. This is also, from what I've seen, maybe You Only Live Twice is kind of like this too, but this is also one of the rare Bond films from these early ones that has gotten more of a negative appraisal as it's gotten older. Most people don't like it now. So it still has a holds a Rotten Tomatoes score of 66, which isn't terrible. That's probably fair. But I just thought that was interesting because most of them, it seems like everybody likes them more now than they did then. This one is like the opposite. Like it seemed to be kind of a success at the time and people enjoyed it, but then now people don't really seem to care for it. It was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Sound. All right. So that's kind of it. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about on the behind the
scenes?
I don't think so. All right. So that kind of sets us up. So now we're going to go to a segment we'd like to call A Review to a Kill.
I've got you in my sights.
Get the fuck out of my sight before I demolish you.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
There's no need to shout. I'm not shouting.
Why don't you stop your whining and get on with it? I've heard this shit before.
We're going to give you our thoughts on whatever film we are discussing this week. This week, we are discussing Diamonds Are Forever. Diamonds Are Forever is a movie that my opinion changes on it as I watch it, while I talk about it. It's a weird one. I don't think I can ever quite get to like, but it's even like I would say, even though it's not, it's definitely, I would say it's the worst of the Connery films that we've seen. You Only Live Twice would be in that conversation, but I think it's probably the worst. But it might be more watchable, or at least it might have, I think it has like a, like it's not as good as Thunderball, it's not as good as Dr. No, but it's a lot easier to watch as a whole, if that makes sense. Like it just it has a better flow to it, I guess. That's kind of my initial two cents on it. What do you think about this film?
I don't like it very much.
Yeah.
There are characters I like, and I like Jill St. John a lot.
Yeah,
I think she's good. That's my type of gal, basically.
Yeah. No, I gotcha.
A lot of things plot wise about this movie are like all over the place for me. I know that they really wanted to have that elevator fight with him and the real Franks, that's in this movie. But I don't know why he allows him to go all the way in there in the first place. Yeah. Like, why doesn't he just, cause he's pretending to be making out with someone outside while Franks hits the button and then says his name and everything to Jill St. John upstairs. And I know that later he's able to pop in James Bond business card or something to make it seem like he killed James Bond, but like that's not even necessary at this point because he's already proven with his fingerprints that he's Franks. And so like I'm sitting there just going, I understand you wanted an elevator fight scene, but you could have just taken him out outside and it would have been the same deal or whatever. Maybe he's worried about law enforcement showing up. I don't know, but he allows a lot of this type of stuff to happen. I don't know if all the stuff they do to get the diamonds and I mean, I understand like there's so many things about these diamonds and what's going on and who's working for who that kind of confuses me throughout this movie. Mm-hmm. I guess Blofeld is has been doing this smuggling thing for a while, and it just so happens to be the end of the line where he has got enough diamonds that he needs. So now he's killing everybody involved with it. So that's why he needs Mr. Kidd and Mr. Wendt to show up. I guess that's the reason why that happens. But it's like what doesn't make sense is that by the time they get to the school teacher,
oh my God, I hate that person. By the way, go ahead.
Yeah, I do too. They get to the school teacher and she welcomes them like they're the ones that have always shown up with the diamonds.
Yeah.
Doesn't she get a visit from the people who actually bring the diamonds? She's the only one that seems to know who Wendt and Kidd are.
Yeah, no, she acts like she knows them. I mean, obviously the actress is fine. She's like a teacher. The character is a teacher and she does that thing where she like, that teacher thing where you over enunciate everything and it always drives me crazy. So like that's her entire like 2 minute performance is her just like, you know, over enunciating every like, oh, where are we going this time?
Yeah.
Amsterdam. So, like, lovely, you know?
So a lot of that stuff at the beginning, like I'm like, okay, I guess Wendt and Kidd are working with Blofeld. And I guess these other guys have been working with Blofeld, but nobody knows who Wendt and Kidd are until they run into this school teacher in the Netherlands. So I'm like, okay, And then there's that whole thing where they have the fake diamonds that they put inside the real Frank's body, which, like, I think we talked about this. Like, what were they going to do if they didn't have the real Frank showed up? Because the real Frank's had to break out of his prison or whatever to get to this place. Like, what were they going to do to smuggle them in before?
Not to mention that chandelier or whatever, the way they hide the diamonds, that's ridiculous. Like, why would you go through all that trouble? Like, just, I mean, how is hiding a suitcase under a bed not a better solution than building a chandelier that you've got to now take apart?
Yeah, yeah. It's where they least suspect it. And then the real diamonds themselves end up getting picked up by Q somewhere in all this.
Yeah.
I don't even know where that happens.
Yeah,
and
I didn't understand
that at all. And he puts it in a plush toy and all that. And they obviously need to have the fake ones so that they can go to the wherever that leads them next. Mm-hmm. I understand that.
Well, and it ends up saving Bond's life too somehow, which is ridiculous.
Right, right. Yeah. And you have this, you know, you have this shady tree guy that shows up, and like, it's like the whole thing is like the fake diamonds, the real diamonds. Who's working for who? Who's doing that? Who's doing what? Because like, when Went and Kid try to kill Bond, I guess they're assuming that he's got the real ones, the real diamonds.
Yeah.
So they just have to kill him. And like, it's for a while there, it looks like Shady Tree and Went and Kid are not a part of the same team. I don't even know why you need Shady Tree there.
I don't know.
By the way, doesn't make any sense. But then he looks into seeing him in the newspaper. He's a comic, a stand up comic that shows up at the White House.
Yeah, he's like a mafia guy, and he's also like George Burns. It's the like Don Rickles or something. It's the weirdest
kind of like that. And he's obviously got this really old, tired act that he does, same jokes over and over and over and over again. But I just if you've got Went and Kid, I don't even know why you even bother with all these other people unless you're just you've got to have a lead of some sort, and that's the only reason why they put him in there. So there's a lot of weird stuff.
I think it's probably something too, like Blofeld had to kind of start making his, like, I guess he had to kind of create some kind of something going on in Vegas, and maybe he had to work with some of the like mobsters and stuff to kind of get, you know, to the point that he got it to, and then he started killing them off.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think Blofeld's a huge problem in this movie. I think Blofeld being the Willard White impersonator is a problem because it's insane. Like Connery in the pre-credit sequence, he's getting his revenge, and Blofeld obviously is not the, I'll go ahead and say this, Blofeld is not the villain in the book, because the book is before they even introduce Blofeld in the novels. It's a completely different villain in the novel. But the idea that Connery, or that Bond gets his thinks he gets his revenge on Blofeld in this really terrible pre-credit sequence. Maybe the worst sequence.
It's really so bad.
Everything about it is horrible. Even the way it's shot, it's just bad.
Well, they don't show him. Like, I guess this is like, it's on purpose that they're doing that, where they don't show Bond at all, but they show the people he's
so
interrogating.
Yeah.
And like a lot of the stuff is just bad in principle. The action is bad. Like, dude, at the beginning, it's just thrown at an impossible angle into this room. Then he goes and is like, "Where's Blofeld?" And he says Cairo, but he doesn't say.
Yeah.
You can see the actor is not saying Cairo
at all.
And then he goes to Cairo and he finds the guy who's gambling and he says, "Hit me." And of course, the guy Bond is right behind him when he says that, and then he tells him to see some girl, and then he pulls her bikini top off.
Oh yeah, let me get something off your chest.
And wraps it around her and asking where. It's just, you know, I understand you're looking for revenge, but that's a really shitty way to do it.
And then I guess Blofeld is kind of like, Blofeld is creating all these other Blofelds. Like, at first, like, when the plastic surgery thing comes up, I'm thinking, oh, that makes sense because Blofeld looks different. But then it's not that. Mm-hmm. It's just that he wants other people to look like him. And so Bond comes in the middle of that, ends up thinking he kills Blofeld, but I guess he kills one of the people that have had plastic surgery, and then gets put on a case randomly that Blofeld ends up being behind. It's so dumb. I mean, it just, there is nothing about that. Like, I cannot, like, even if I enjoy parts of this movie, like the central storyline, I will never be able to get my head around. Like, it doesn't work. Like, on a fundamental level, it just doesn't work. Like, it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then when he confronts Blofeld, he's not even, like, that weird about it. Like, he's just like, oh, well, I guess Blofeld pulled another one on me. Once again, mm-hmm. just, we're not even going to mention that, like, we're not even going to deal with any kind of psychological, you know, stuff that's got to be going on after he lost his wife the day he married her. Mm-hmm. In fact, he's really quick to just start hooking up with.
Yeah, it's just completely just swept it under the rug completely.
It's crazy. And then make Blofeld, like I said, then make Blofeld be who, and like, that's what I'm saying. Like, in M and MI6, they have no idea that's Blofeld. They think it's Willard mm-hmm. White is the person. So
yeah,
they think it's the Jimmy Dean guy.
And this is another part of the movie too. Like, you're not really supposed to follow every single detail of these movies. You're just supposed to kind of be like, okay, well, this is where we're at now and whatever. But man, they do that technique that confused a lot of people in Mission Impossible mm-hmm. when John Voight is talking about what really happened at the mission that blew up in their faces, and Cruz is sitting there thinking about what actually happened while Voight is telling his lie about what happened. And so, like, you're sitting there going, what the hell is going on? And then you realize, oh, that's what it is. So they do that in this Bond movie as well, when the guy is talking about the diamond operation, and he's talking about how they smuggle the diamonds, or they're wondering how the diamonds are smuggled out. And so he's telling this, like, well, you know, we assume that there's some smuggling and blah, 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 but we've got, you know, we could deal with that. By the way, we also have like a full dental, full medical, blah, blah, blah. And while they're saying the full dental, you see these guys coming in,
oh my God,
like getting dental work and they're getting diamonds pulled out of their teeth. And that's how they stay. So it's like a lot of this stuff is like what the guy is saying and what we're seeing on screen often contradict each other.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of go through with that. And then you have to, like I said, that the trip that these real diamonds and the fake diamonds go through this whole thing, just insane to me. But
yeah, no, I agree. And then making Blofeld behind it all just coincidentally it's gonna be like your arch nemesis.
Oh yeah, and he's just found this, like, or does he even have time to do this also? Like, if we're looking at Blofeld and the past couple of movies, which are, even though the books are in different order, the movies are saying this is all in order.
Yeah.
When does Blofeld have time to hang out in Vegas?
He's had to
have been doing this for several years. Meanwhile, he was also in Switzerland the whole time in this last movie, and he was on this stupid, like, whatever base it was in You Only Live Twice. So, like, they could easily, you know what, I know that a producer can sit there and just say, there are many Blofelds, like it's Santa Claus or something, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. Those are his lieutenants, you know, and all that. But it seems like Blofeld has a lot of time on his hands to just go to, and like, oh, by the way, Willard White is this guy who, he's a recluse. So you can take over his identity if you want to, and like pretend to be him with this vocoder thing or whatever, this voice changing thing. Like, how do you find that out? And then how do you install yourself into that? You know, during this, it's just a lot of stuff going on.
I do like how Bond throws that back on him though, and does the whole like where he pretends he's Bird.
Oh yeah. By the way, I don't know. I don't think we did this in the Sins video, but I think Bert showing up to White's like summer house doesn't make sense because it was Blofeld who told Bond, who he thought was Bert, to come out and kill White, and later on he just shows up. And I guess they could have said that, you know, like Blofeld gave that order and then made sure to call him later and tell him again or something. I don't know, but
yeah, 'cause
it seems like Bert shows up, even though he shouldn't know at that point, to go kill White.
Because he's the one that tries to kill Bond. I get the impression that Blofeld, I mean, I don't think they do a good job of explaining it. I read that as, though, because Bambi and Thumper, who we haven't even mentioned yet, these two women that are seeing over Willard White, they are like ready to attack Bond. So like, I get the impression Blofeld didn't buy it or figured out pretty quickly that it wasn't him. But it like they don't show that. Like maybe there's a deleted scene where he calls Bert or Bert calls
it
later.
It could be, but it also could be that they're attacking anybody who goes through that section of the house. Some stranger is just showing up in the house.
That's true.
So.
That's true. And if it had been Bert, they might have been like, "Oh, okay, it's you. You're good."
But I think the movie is saying, "Oh yeah, yeah, Bert knows to go kill Willard White," and it's like, he told Bond who he thought was Bert Saxby that.
And we haven't even mentioned either Blofeld. I mean, the whole thing he wants to do with the diamonds. The only reason, as far as I could figure out, he's using the diamonds is he wants to build this like space laser that he can like he can destroy any place he wants to destroy from space.
Yeah.
And so he's going to use that basically to, you know, have the US like kind of bend to his, you know, like he destroys that submarine or whatever, and I don't know, it's so dumb. And why wouldn't you just like take all the diamonds and then completely screw up like the diamond supply, you know, going into the, I mean, that would be a way, you know, I don't know.
But, which is funny because that's exactly what they do in, was it License to Kill or was it?
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think that's what, it's one of those, there's another movie where they're trying to like wipe out the diamond industry or whatever.
Goldfinger does
that. No, it's Goldfinger.
Yeah.
It's Goldfinger
that does
that. Goldfinger does
that with the gold. They want to poison all the gold basically in Fort Knox.
Is it License to Kill?
There is some diamond stuff, like in, I believe it's License to Kill. I think you're right. Oddly enough, there's some stuff in the novel that definitely gets used in License to Kill, which is interesting. But I mean, even if you look past like the elephant and the car chase, which is terrible, and the openings, I mean, there's all these things that are so dumb, like the guy reaching into his jacket and he has like a mouse trap in there. And
there's
like so many things like that.
Just in case somebody wanders around your hand, like gets a little too handsy, there's a mouse trap.
I know. I want the scene where Q is explaining to Bond why they made that. Like, this is just in case, you know, they go for your gun.
If they pat you down, then the jig's up immediately because they know that you're hostile to them. So
I'm trying to think. I forgot to mention, I should have mentioned this. And the other thing, Felix Leiter's back because we're in the U.S. Norman Burton plays him this time. I really like, that's one thing I've discovered watching these movies is that I don't really care for. I think we've already talked about this, but Felix Leiter's such a nothing character.
Like, who gives a shit?
Yeah. I know, it's crazy.
Yeah,
I don't even know why they had him. But
well, and then that's the another one. That's a really weird reintroduction to his character
at the airport.
Yeah, because Connery shows up and like they have the body of Frank's there.
Yeah,
and like and there's a guy who's going over to inspect the stuff, but Felix Leiter just happens to be at the airport, and he's got the power to tell that guy to go to lunch or something.
Yeah.
Like, I guess a CIA guy can go in and pretend to be some.
Like, I don't know.
This guy's like, yeah, no problem. I've never seen you before, but I'll go over to lunch. Why not?
Also, I had written down too the Baja thing, which we said this. I know we did, but the fact that like. Blofeld took the time to add that Baja location on Willard White's like Willard White has like this visual map. I don't know what this is supposed to be. It's like you saw these around this time. Like I know like in like one of the Superman movies, this is a big, I think it's Superman 3. Mm-hmm. It's just these crazy like bad guy layers, and they have these like physical like maps where they have like models and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And for and some
it's all
reason
built in the floor.
Yeah. And Blofeld adds this Baja thing so Willard White can be like, wait a second, I don't have anything in Baja.
Well, and not only the fact that he added it there, but the fact that Bond goes through that whole spiel like he could be anywhere from New York to this to from Florida to California to blah blah to Baja. He doesn't have to go so far into this, but when he says Baja, that's when like, oh wait a minute, I don't have anything in Baja. Jimmy Dean.
Jimmy Dean, bless his heart, man. He has some really tasty restaurants though, but he's not great. It's not, I mean, I don't think that character, I don't know who could have played that character and it would have been great. And he does actually have some funny moments. Like,
yeah,
I like when he's yelling at the guy he's talking to on the phone. That's like at the space center or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some stuff like that.
If there are any problems with Diamonds Are Forever, he's like among the least of them.
Exactly. So. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, which speaking of License to Kill, that makes me think about how Wayne Newton is in License to Kill, but,
but anyways,
this is our review of License to Kill.
Yeah.
But Yeah, Diamonds Are Forever, it's not good. I don't like it. I do weirdly find it watchable, though. Like, I wouldn't put it at the very bottom because I think there are movies that are hard. I think there are movies that are way harder to get through than this one. There's not, I'm not bored. Like, I'm not necessarily, I don't know if I'm interested, but I'm not like super uninterested in what's going on. I like Jill St. John. Mm-hmm. I love Bruce Glover and, what was it? Putter Smith. I, they're great. Like, I don't even know how to explain how much I love them. I'm so sad. This is their only Bond film and they get like the worst send off too. That's terrible too.
They
that
do,
game at the
yeah.
end. And as smart as they've been the whole movie, they are so dumb in that scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, the fact that Bond realizes it's him because of the aftershave is stupid, and that's not their fault. But I still think just the way they act and they give themselves away way too quickly, and it just
and then
he comes at him with the flaming shish kebab.
Yeah, the shish kebab things. Yeah, and he's able to spray wine on him or whatever. And this also is probably the number one most exasperating why don't they just kill Bond
there's a lot of
why don't they just kill Bond, and of course again I've mentioned this before, they say this and they do this in Austin Powers a bunch because the Seth Green character is always saying I'll just get a gun and I'll just shoot him right now. One of all of them maybe, I mean it adds like 10 to 15 minutes to the picture too. First off, Blofeld tells him to go in this elevator and he goes in the elevator and there's gas
some trap.
And there's all this gas, it knocks him out, so then you have Went and Kid show up and pick him up and put him in the trunk. And then they drive him off somewhere, and they're like, all right, we're going to put him in this pipe. We know that this construction is going on, and we can put him in this pipe. And then in the morning, the construction team, without looking, puts this pipe down into the ground. And then there's like some weird mechanical robot thing that shows up later on that's supposed to run over him or shock him or something. We've seen Went and Kid like blow people up like immediately in this. And every time Bond shows up, Blofeld like has seen now Bond get out of situations numerous times. And at this point, why do you want him to just stay around? Why do you want him to have a chance anymore?
And when they were already going to kill him at the beginning, they were putting him in the incinerator and he was going to die then. So it's like, why are you talking to him?
That's the thing. Every time they're about to just kill him, and especially in that very first scene, the dude is about to come out of that goop and he's about to shoot him before, you know, Bond, because he's always aware that there's a gun being pointed at him. He stops it. But that's the thing they do a lot in these movies where it's like, okay, we were going to kill you here. Now, for some reason, we're going to tell you what's going on, and then we're going to kill you. But it's not going to be immediate. It's going to be something we put you into, and then that's going to kill you. And of course, you're going to get out. And then he gets out once again in this movie, and he's still just talking to Bond later on. Like when the balloon comes down into the water at the very end, they're like, nope, don't shoot. Hold your fire.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Why?
Well, and why do they bury him where they bury him? They have an entire desert. And they bury him in this one location where he will have air and he will potentially be able to escape because they're in this whole pipe system, you know?
Yeah.
I actually wrote this line down too where the people unscrew because he breaks that machine. So then that gets the people that work on the construction site, they have to show up and find out why that machine got broken. And when they open the thing, he pops out. He says, I was just out walking my rat and I seem to have lost my way. He talks to a mouse too, by the way.
It's one of the dumbest lines ever.
It's terrible.
And those people, by the way, those people aren't saying the lines
they're not. That
it's
a lot
complete,
of these movies
complete
we found
ADR.
Out.
It's so it's hard to get around it though. Like,
I know, it's crazy.
They're saying things like it's like clearly saying things, and these people are just kind of like they got their mouth shut the whole time.
There's this Roger Ebert review I've always remembered. When he reviewed there was that movie with Cindy Crawford and I think William Baldwin. It was called
Fair Game.
It was William or Steven. I think it was William, wasn't it? I don't know.
This was William, yeah.
But Cindy Crawford plays like this lawyer, and she gets wind of something, and then so these bad guys have to kill her because she has this information. And they're trying to kill her the whole movie. Like, they blow up her house, they shoot at her, all this stuff. And then when they finally get, I remember Roger Ebert talks about this in his review, and he like details all this. And then when they actually have her in front of them, they talk to her, you know, mm-hmm. and that's exactly what this is. And that's a problem with a lot of movies like this. I mean, Bond is not it's not the first. It's definitely not the last to have this issue.
And it's not the only one.
No, it's not the only.
But the problem for me is that the same villain, he's running into the same villain
it's crazy.
Over and over and over again, and every time there's a moment where insta-kill is okay, and then after the insta-kill they're like, nah, we're not going to insta-kill you anymore, we're going to put you in a thing now. And then he escapes that, and it's like, well, maybe I should stop putting him in these contraptions at this point. And again, Austin Powers covered this territory. Everybody's covered this territory before. But in this movie in particular, it was the most exasperating.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Up to this point, definitely. This is the one where it makes less sense. Because like you were talking about the elevator. Before the elevator, he has him trapped in this room where he could probably just kill him or something. Yep. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But instead tells him to go ahead and go to the bathroom if he needs to, because he's apparently...
And,
he's apparently in a bathroom.
And also that whole laser depends on a fucking cassette tape, man.
Oh my! I forgot about that. I mean,
he brings some other cassette tape to switch it out, which I guess makes sense. But really, you could just pull it out and never put another tape in.
Exactly.
From what I understand, but like. They even let him in that room they let him in the control room for any reason. And like, of course he ejects the tape. They allow him to get anywhere near that at all. And he ejects the tape, and of course he puts the fake one in, but then you think, oh no, all is lost, because he gives Jill St. John the real tape, and she thinks that she has to switch it out.
Yeah.
I don't even know why he even put that tape in.
Oh, well, he did, because Blofeld stupidly said, hey, go ahead and frisk him again. I don't know why you just, like, blurted that out. So he had to put it somewhere, I guess. But
he could have just, he doesn't have to say that the answer is behind you or whatever he says to her.
Exactly.
When he puts it down in her bikini bottoms, he could just say,
God,
keep this with you at all times or whatever.
Well, and
or something.
She shouldn't be alive either, because Blofeld already tried to have her killed, and they killed Plenty O'Toole instead, because they made the mistake. So really, it doesn't make any sense why she's still alive. Like, I guess maybe she just promised him sex or something. I don't know.
I don't know.
Because Blofeld does make some comments like, I love those cheeks, or those are really nice cheeks or something. So I get the impression they've had a relationship of some sort. But I, fuck if I know. It's like you said, it's exasperating. I can't quite get it at the very bottom, because I know there's films.
Oh, it is not at the bottom, but it's in the lower third.
Yes, for sure. And I haven't seen Never Say Never Again in forever, but I'm pretty sure this is the worst, in my opinion, of the Connery films. I guess we can go into our rankings, unless there's something else you want to talk about.
Nope.
All right, so for our rankings, we're going to rank this film in five different categories. Our scale will be based on something that Bond holds near and dear to his heart, as long as they are shaken and not stirred. So for each category, we will rank from 1 to 5 martinis, 5 being the best damn liquid that has ever passed your lips, 1 being the well liquor you had to settle for or were too drunk to care that night. And first off, I guess we'll talk about just, which we've kind of been talking about this, but the overall story, the overall movie. This is about the easiest 2 I think I've given yet.
The easiest what? Because
two out of five. Okay. 2 out of 5martinis.
Yeah, absolutely. Same here.
I don't know if there's really much. We've kind of discussed the story.
Thank God for Kid and Went and Jill St. John, or else this is a 1 out of 5 probably.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I will also say, because next we're going to do The Bond, which is Connery's performance. And I will say one thing going into this, and I don't know if this is just stuff I had heard people say or whatever, but it had been a minute since I had watched a lot of these Connery films. And at least I know I mentioned this in earlier episodes, like it kind of gets to a point where it feels like Connery doesn't really care as much. But I got to be honest, if Connery, along with what you just mentioned, if Connery isn't in this film, I don't know that it works at all. I think it probably is a one. I think Connery's actually okay in this. I think it, when he's not good, it has to do with the writing. I don't think it has anything to do with him. Like, he's fine. Mm-hmm. It's weird that he seems to have, like we've already said a thousand times, he has like no issue. He's not suffering or anything, which is really odd, but that's not Connery's fault. That's the writing, right? So he's playing the character that they wrote. He's perfectly fine. I don't even know that it's his worst performance. Maybe it is, but I'd still give it a 3 because he's fine, you know?
I probably should have said this in the last segment, but there is one more ridiculous nonsense that's in this movie. When they go to the White House, he and Jill St. John go to the White House and stay there, and then Felix goes in and tries to make sure that he doesn't leave.
Yeah,
and he puts out these guards outside of his door so he can't do anything. So Bond goes out onto the ledge, and he walks straight over where there's an elevator just happens to be there. That goes along the side of the building, and it goes all the way to the top level, where he barely has to kind of crouch down and make sure that, you know, he stays up there. Of course, the elevator leaves, and then that's when he's like, this is all seemingly just without thinking. Like, I don't even understand what he's doing here. He grabs onto a bar while that elevator goes down so that he can stay up there. Like, what, man, just... So he stays up there, and then he has like all these gadgets that are ready to go, like these little zipline things.
Yeah, and it's like for climbing and stuff. Yeah,
right. That's what you keep in your suit at all times.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
is where it gets in. Like, this is where it would have made sense if Adam West was the was Bond, because that's what those Batman show was all about.
Yeah, where you have the gadgets pop out the window and talk to
ready
them
to go.
Stuff.
Yeah. So that whole scene too, like just and the fact that Blofeld is expecting Bond to show up during that whole thing, because he crashes through what is the bathroom, and then like Blofeld's like, hey, he's talking as Willard White at the time. I keep wanting to say Walter White because it's just the way
it
is. But he's Willard White's like, all right, now you got a hog leg on you. Take that hog leg off. And I'm like, sitting there, man, you thought this was possible, that he was going to be able to get up to the penthouse, however way it was. You were ready for this, and now you're putting him in an elevator and gassing him and letting Kid and Went put him in a pipe.
Oh,
anyway, I think this is a 2 out of 5 for sure. These kind of scenes, these insane kind of scenes can be great if they make any sense whatsoever, but I agree.
These, in a better movie, some of this stuff we're saying the opposite about. So I'm sorry, that's 2 out of 5. That's a story. What about Connery? Are you giving him a 2 out of 5 too?
Connery, I've never really noticed too much difference between the performances. I think in the first two, he's clearly, I think he's excited to be playing this role. And the second one, he's living in this role really well. And then after that, he's just kind of comfortable doing this role. So like, I don't think there's any like high or low or low point here. Like, I think he's a 3 out of 5 here.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably a borderline one for me. Like, I'd probably be closer to like 2.5, but like I think he's better here than he actually is in You Only Live Twice. I think he's a little better here.
Yeah.
The gadgets, I mean, I don't know. I that's one thing going into these, and maybe they do play more into it as we get further into this series. I feel like there's a lot more gadgets, especially when we get like with Roger Moore.
Yeah.
But I've thought about just taking this out of the rankings because this doesn't ever seem to be that interesting to talk about. But in this one, you have like the mousetrap, which we already discussed.
Yeah.
You have the climbing shit. He's already got ready to go.
Yeah.
I feel like there's something else I'm missing. Oh, the voice changer, I guess.
But
counts.
The voice changer isn't. I mean, Q does build one. He's, and he says tossed off some line like, I built one for my kid last Christmas, or grandson or something. And like, yeah, I guess that's kind of cool.
That grandson ended up becoming the first Ghostface. I don't know if you knew that. It's pretty fascinating story.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. That's crazy. It's so amazing.
See what Q did?
I know. But yeah, I would give the gadgets like a 2 out of 5.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. I don't know what else to give them because there's nothing that interesting about it. And there really hasn't been. I mean, I guess like maybe there's some stuff like in Goldfinger and Thunderball we've talked about, but I don't know. So far, they haven't been all that exciting. The villain, this was also a pretty easy 2 out of 5 for me. I mean, I just, I do. Well, the henchmen actually, I mean, Kid and Wendt, they almost bring it up. So maybe this is closer to like a 2.5, but Blofeld is, and nothing against the acting. I mean, Charles Gray's fine. It is nothing. It's just so ridiculous that Blofeld's the villain. It's just so dumb.
Yeah.
And for that alone, I'm giving it a 2.
Yeah, I would also give this a 2, and it's all on the strength of Kid and Wendt. So.
Yeah, the song is definitely Goldfinger Light, but I don't hate the song.
I don't hate it either, but this song doesn't do anything for me.
No.
This Diamonds Are Forever. Like, I this may be sacrilege for a lot of people to hear, but I like this better in the Kanye West song, the Diamonds from Sierra Leone, than like in the actual original song. So,
no, I think you're right.
The original song has like a couple of moments where like I can kind of get into this, but for it, it does not have that same like how Goldfinger comes in. Goldfinger's when like that. The way that the whole thing, the whole arrangement of that song is amazing, and then this one is kind of like All right. Yeah, you got Shirley Bassey back. Good.
Yeah, that's it's 100% on Shirley Bassey because there's nothing else interesting about it. But she's good. Like I like her, and it's you know, it's fine. I was kind of in that 2.5. I might give it like a borderline 3, but I wasn't.
Yeah, I will settle at 2 on this one. This song is just never. And I think the last time I watched this, I was expecting this to blow me away more too. And maybe it's the level expectation I've set, but. But it just doesn't. It just doesn't do anything.
I hear you. All right. So that's our review. So we're going to get one last segment where we're going to talk about the book. This is a segment we call Spy Who Reads Me.
Reading is one of my very favorite things to do.
Whoa! I'm not reading that crap. Summarize it in one word.
Now you want to talk about reading? Let's talk about reading.
How can you read this? There's no pictures.
CinemaSins might have taught you that books don't matter, but for this segment, we are willing to concede they at least kind of do. We are going to give you the nitty-gritty on what is similar to what you saw on the screen, what is different, and there will be plenty of what the hell was Ian Fleming smoking when he wrote this, although not in this case. This book is maybe my least favorite so far. It's but mainly because it's really dull. Like it's just it's a really dull book. And this is a pretty loose adaptation. So obviously the title is the same. The diamond smuggling aspect of it is in the book. Like there's a chain of diamond smuggling going on. They want Bond to figure out what the hell's happening. There's not like a laser, space laser, shit like that, but there is diamond smuggling. It's probably a lot more in line with what's in License to Kill, where it's kind of more that 80s idea where you just have like drug smugglers and drug dealers and stuff like that. That's kind of what's going on here. And it has a lot to do with like the American mob. And the main villains are these brothers called the Spang brothers. Serafimo and Jack Spang, they're smuggling blood diamonds from Africa. So he does go undercover as, what is the guy? Peter, I think I wrote it down again. Peter Franks. That whole thing happens. He does go undercover as Peter Franks. They basically kidnap Peter Franks to make sure that nobody, he doesn't end up like he ends up in the movie, ends up in the elevator or whatever. That doesn't happen in the book, but Bond goes undercover as Peter Franks. He's trying to get in with the Spang brothers so he can bring them down. And so some of it's similar, other than, like I said, obviously Blofeld's not the villain because he wasn't even a thought, to Ian Fleming. This is the fourth book, by the way, in the series. It's right after Moonraker, right before From Russia with Love in the book series. Most of the supporting characters are in the book. Tiffany Case is in the book. Shady Tree is in the book. Shady Tree, he's definitely more straight up mafia though. There's not like a big, stand up comedy routine going on there. They're in it. Kid and Wendt are in it as well. However, they're barely in it. So they're not anywhere near as interesting. Felix Leiter is in the book. However, in Live and Let Die, which was the book, did I say that was the one right? I think Live and Let Die is the book number 2, which I haven't read yet. But apparently in Live and Let Die, Felix Leiter gets attacked by a shark, which is what happens in License to Kill. He is maimed by a shark, and the CIA has to let him go after that because I guess they just don't, they can't use him anymore because he's been injured. So he's a Pinkerton detective in this book. And Bond actually ends up getting in touch with him because he needs Felix to help him get closer in with the Spang brothers. There's this whole weird, weird, weird side plot where the mob won't pay Bond as Peter Franks. They won't pay him. And so he's trying to like get them to pay him. And there's like all this bullshit about this. What they end up doing is they send him to Vegas. This is how he ends up in Vegas. And they have him go play. They tell him to go to this specific table. When he goes there, Tiffany Case is the dealer and she deals him 5 winning hands. So that's how they pay him basically under the table. And but then he takes that money and he goes to the roulette wheel. And he ends up winning a shit ton more money. This ends up pissing off the mob. They shoot at him the next day and his driver. They end up kidnapping him. They take him to this ghost town in Vegas somewhere. And that's where he runs into one of the Spang brothers is there and is torturing him and trying to find out all this information and stuff. Tiffany Case comes in and saves him in a really dumb way. And then Felix ends up rescuing both of them because he figures it out. Like, he just, it's not interesting at all. He just like he has like this thought or something. He's like, oh, I think they're in this ghost town now. And then he goes and rescues them. It's ridiculous.
All right.
Yep. Like I said, the book does have Mr. Went and Mr. Kidd. But they're seriously minor characters. In fact, I had kind of forgotten they were even in the book. But then they do pop up in the end, and there is kind of a variation on what happens on the cruise ship. In the movie, that is how they try to kill Tiffany Case and Bond. But then after that, there's a whole sequence where Bond he goes to Africa, and he actually takes down the smuggling operation, ends up killing the other Spang brother. There's also a horse race subplot, which doesn't really have shit to do with anything, but I thought that was interesting because they definitely go back to that. They definitely go back to that in A View to a Kill. There's another one too where a horse race pops up, but I think it's Quantum of Solace was the other one that was mentioned. That they take a little bit of this, and that's what we're gonna find out. We get to some of these later Bond films. They definitely take from a lot of the other. The other novels. So this one has some stuff in it that's similar, but overall it's pretty different. But honestly, the movie's better just in the sense that the movie's not boring. This book is just, it's like, these have been pretty quick reads for me, and this one was a little harder to get through. I even got to the point at one point where I'm like, am I gonna finish this or should I just start looking shit up? Because I it was a hard one to get through, so not a high recommend for me. But that's the one case where I would say the movie's better is definitely this one. So that's what we thought about Diamonds Are Forever. It's like I said, it's watchable. But I wouldn't. I don't know that I'd recommend it. I mean, there's no reason to skip it necessarily. But and I would say like this might be a great just Saturday afternoon background. Just have some bullshit
on.
Sure,
there are moments in here that are worthwhile. And look, this movie and You Only Live Twice definitely vie for like the worst of the Connery.
There's no
doubt about it. And I think this may have more fun in it than You Only Live Twice does.
But what's interesting is they have two of the more interesting Bond girls though, which is kind of fascinating. I really like Jill St. John. Like that was kind of I just didn't really have much of a memory of her at all. It wasn't like I disliked her, but I just didn't really think about it. But yeah, she really hit me this time too. I thought she was just different, I love that first scene with them actually where, I mean, it's kind of silly that she's in her underwear and stuff, but I just like that, she's figuring out everything and making sure. I still don't know how he had that thumbprint though, or that fingerprint. That's kind of ridiculous,
Q gave him.
No, I know, but I'm just saying, I don't know how that shit works though. I just think that's.
I don't either. Yeah. But I mean, I'm assuming because Franks is already in the system, they're able to make a plastic cast of it of some sort.
I guess so.
Now, it's silly in the movie because that's something that Q thinks of for this particular operation, and then I don't think it ever comes up again anywhere else in any other Bond movie or whatever, that he's got somebody else's fingerprints just in case they go and check a glass or something. Anyway. And by the way, there was...
Go ahead, sorry.
What? Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I wonder, like, if you had Jill St. John and... Kid and went like in Thunderball, like does that make that like a, you know, like a lot better? I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know, but that was, I was reminded of, there was one other gadget, but that didn't have anything to do with the plot of the movie, is when Q is using that thing to make the slot machines all
no, that's
and
cool.
He's winning all the money or whatever during it, and I was like, oh, Q, that's kind of illegal, man, what are you doing?
And also,
and
it goes off to that weird
scene with Jill St. John, like running after Blofeld, who's dressed up as a woman,
and all that.
There's so,
like,
many weird things.
There's too much to remember. Like, it's just, it's the insanity of, like, every scene in this movie is just,
right.
It's just like, it's like cocaine run rampant or something.
It really is kind of like that, yeah.
Also, before we go, we have social media. You can reach us on Twitter. We are at GoldSpy007. You can also reach out to me directly on Twitter. I am at SamLoomis13. You can email us at golddiamonddeath007@gmail.com. And if you like this podcast and other things under the CinemaSins brand, we also have a Patreon you can join at patreon.com/CinemaSins. And if you have a second to leave us a 5-star review at your podcast listening app of choice, we would appreciate it. Thank you for joining us this week. And like I said, we hope you will join us again next week. We will talk about Live and Let Die. Until then, keep the martinis dry and shaken, the Baccarat shoe moving, and the Aston Martin fully gassed. This is Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins signing off, and we will see you next mission.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.